General China stared at the map as though it were a portrait of the white man's face. Once again he experienced the bitter disappointment and frustration. He'd almost had the white man in his grasp, pinned down by his pursuit troops, with no possible avenue of escape. And then had come the Frelimo intervention. The forest below him had been obliterated by the roiling clouds of smoke and the screaming of his men on the radio, crying for help as the flames engulfed them. Tipu Tipa tried in vain to convince him that Sean Courtney had perished with them in the forest fire. But General China knew better than that. He had dropped his own trackers from the hind into the blackened ashes as soon as they had cooled sufficiently for men to walk upon them. They had found the spot where the white man had buried his people to evade the heat. The marks of their bodies were still imprinted in the soft earth, and they had found the tracks leading away southwards, ever southwards. For the rest of that day, China had searched from the low-flying hind, but the smoke had hampered him, limiting his vision to the small circle directly beneath the hind's belly. If anything, this additional failure had intensified his determination. The white man's cunning and his outrageous good fortune in evading all China's best efforts only aggravated his hatred and inflamed his longing for revenge. During those long hours when they had ferried his last line of assault troops into position, China had sustained himself with fantasies of vengeance, dreaming up the most bizarre ordeals for Sean Courtney and his woman, once he had them in his power. There would be no haste then. He would draw out the pleasure, eking out their suffering and pain as jealously as a miser his shekels. He would begin with a woman, of course, and the white man would watch it all. After Tipu Tip had enjoyed her to the full, they would hand her over to the men. China would personally select the most repulsive, those with hideous features, deformed bodies, and elephantine members. Some of his men were truly remarkable in their physical development. He would let them have the woman after Tipu Tip, and when they were done, he would bring on the sick and diseased, the men with open venereal ulcers and virulent skin disorders, covered with scabs and tropical sores. Then at last, he would give her to the men with a slim sickness, the most dreaded of all. Yes, it would be marvellous sport. He wondered how strong the American woman was, how many she could take. Would her mind go before her body? It would be fascinating to find out. And of course, the white man would be forced to watch every second of it. Only when the woman was finished would he begin on Colonel Sean Courtney. He had not yet decided what it would be. There would be so many possibilities. However, the man was tough. He could be expected to last for days, perhaps even weeks. Planning it, gloating on it, brought a smile to General China's lips and calmed his frustration enough to allow him to drop into his canvas chair, draw the lapels of his greatcoat around him, and sink at last into sleep. He awoke in confusion, unable to orientate himself. Somebody was shaking him urgently, and he threw off the hands and struggled out of his chair, glaring around him wildly. It was morning. The trees around his temporary base were grey skeletons against the paler grey of the dawn sky. The light bulbs still glowed on their poles above the squatting helicopter, and the radio on the rough table of hand-planed logs in front of him was squawking urgently. "Contact General China! We have a live contact!" It was the commander of the line of men that he had placed upon the hills of the approaches to the Limpopo. He was calling in clear language, proof of his agitation. Still half asleep, China stumbled to the radio set and seized the microphone. "This is Banana Tree. Report your position and status correctly," he snapped. And at the sound of his voice, the distant patrol leader steadied himself and corrected his radio procedure. The fugitives had run into his stop line at almost precisely the point which China had predicted. There had been a brief firefight, and then the fugitive band had taken refuge on the crest of a small koppie, almost within sight of the Limpopo River. "I have called for the motors to come up," the patrol leader exulted. "We'll blow them off the top of that hill."
"Negative," China spoke very clearly. "I say again, negative. Do not open fire on the position with mortars. Do not attack. I want them taken alive. Surround the hill and wait for my arrival.
He glanced across at the helicopter. The titanium engine hatches were back in place, and the Portuguese engineer was overseeing the last of the refueling. A line of porters, each of them with a 25-litre drum balanced on his head, were queued up, waiting their turns to empty the drums into the helicopter's main tanks. China shouted to the engineer in Portuguese, and he came striding across to the tent.
"We must take off immediately," he ordered.
"I will complete the refueling in half an hour."
"That's too long. How much fuel have you got on board right now?"
"Auxiliary tanks are full. Main tank is 3/4.
"That will do. Call the pilot. Tell him we must take off right away."
"I must replace the debris suppressors over the turbo intakes," the engineer protested.
"How long will that take?"
"Not more than half an hour."
"Too long," China shouted with agitation.
The pilot was stumbling along the pathway from his tent. Not yet fully awake, he was pulling on his leather flying jacket, and the flaps of his helmet dangled loosely around his ears.
"Hurry,"
China yelled at him.
"Get her started."
"What about the suppressors?" the engineer insisted.
"We can fly without them. They are only precautionary."
"Yes, but..."
"No," China pushed him away. "I can't wait. Forget about the suppressors. We fly at once. Get the engine started."
With the tails of his greatcoat flapping around his legs, General China ran to the helicopter and scrambled up into his seat in the weapons cockpit. Sean Courtney lay on his belly between two rocks, just below the crest of the kopje, and looked out over the tops of the Mopane forest. Away towards the south, the dark green belt of trees was just visible in the uncertain light. It marked the position of the Limpopo River.
"So close," he lamented. "We so very nearly made it."
It was against all the odds that they had survived this far, almost 300 kilometres through a devastated, war-torn land and two murderous opposing armies, only to be stopped here in sight of their goal. There was a burst of AK fire from down the slope of the hill, and a ricochet sang away into the dawn sky. Matatu lay amongst the rocks nearby, and he was still berating himself.
"I am a stupid old man, my Bwana. You must send me away and get yourself a clever young one who is not blind and decrepit with age."
Sean guessed that a Renamo observation post must have spotted them as they crossed one of the open glades between the hills. There had been no warning, no obvious pursuit, no set ambush. Without warning, a sweep line of tiger-striped figures had rushed at them from out of the Mopane. They'd all been weary after travelling hard all night. Perhaps their concentration had been eroded. Perhaps they should have stayed in the trees instead of cutting across the open flay. But it was vain to think about what they might have done. There had only been sufficient time to snatch up the children and drag the women up the side of the kopje with poorly aimed Renamo fire whining off the rocks around them. Perhaps the Renamo aim had been deliberately wild, Sean pondered. He could guess what General China's orders to his men had been. Take them alive. Where is China now? He wondered. One thing was certain. He was not far away, and coming as fast as the hind would fly. He looked out at the Limpopo River again, and there was the foul taste of failure and disappointment on the back of his tongue. "Alfonso," he called out, "have you got the radio rigged?" It was more for something to occupy his mind than with any real hope of making contact. Twice during the night he had attempted to make the prearranged radio schedule with the South African Army. Once he'd even heard Kudu calling him very faintly. However, the batteries of their radio had finally begun to fail. The battery test needle had dropped back deeply into the red quadrant of the dial.
"If I try to raise the aerial, those baboons down there will shoot my testicles off," Alfonso growled from amongst the rocks.
"It's almost line of sight to the river," Sean told him brusquely. "Give me the aerial."
He raised himself on one elbow and threw the bundle of insulated wire as far down the slope as he could reach,
and then stooped to the radio set. When he turned on the power, the control panel glowed feebly.
Gudu, this is Mossy, he sent out his despairing call. Kudu, do you read me? Kudu, this is Mossy.
A stray bullet hit the rock above his head and Sean ignored it.
Kudu, this is Mossy.
The two women, white and black, were holding the children and watching him wordlessly.
Kudu, this is Mossy.
He adjusted the gain knob, and then, unbelievably, so faintly that he could barely catch the words, a voice answered him.
Mossy, this is Obos. I read you strength 3.
Obos! Oh, God, he breathed. Obos!
Obos, the grandfather, was General Lothar de la Rey's code name.
Obos, we're in deep shit here. Request an immediately hot extraction.
He was asking for a removal while under enemy fire.
We are 7 packs, 5 adults and 2 children. Our position is...
He read out the map coordinates of his dead reckoning position.
We are holding a small copy approximately 20 kilometers north of the Limpopo.
He raised his head and glanced around quickly.
There are 2 large copies approximately 2 miles due east of our position. Do you read me, Obos?
I'll read you, Mossy. The voice faded and then came back. What was your grandmother's maiden name?
Oh, sod you, Sean snarled frustration.
Lothar was double-checking his identity at a time like this.
My grandmother's maiden name was Centaine de Thury, and she's your grandmother also, Lothar, you rotten bastard.
Okay, Mossy, I'm sending a puma in for hot extraction. Can you hold out for 1 hour longer?
Pull finger, Obos. We've got gooks all over us.
We'll go, Mossy.
Sean had to put his ear close to the set to catch the last words.
Give them hell, Sean.
And then the signal faded, and the last flicker of the battery died.
They're coming!
Sean looked up from the radio and grinned across at Claudia.
They're sending a Puma helicopter in to take us out!
And then his grin faded, and all their faces turned slowly towards the north. There was a new sound in the dawn, still faint and far off, but they all recognized it. It was the sound of death. They watched the hind come down from the north, sweeping in low over the forest, a great hunchbacked monster, blotched with camouflage paint, the first rays of the rising sun reflecting off the cockpit canopy like huge glowing red eyes. Out of the Mopane forest at the foot of the kopje, a signal rocket sailed up in a lazy red parabola, calling the hind in, and it altered course slightly and headed directly towards the crest of the hill on which they lay. Claudia was at Sean's side, and he placed his arm over her shoulders.
It's so cruel, she whispered. It's like dying twice over.
She pulled the Takariv pistol from her belt and tried to place it in his hand.
No, he rejected. I can't do it. I can't screw myself up to that again.
He pushed the pistol away.
What then? She asked.
And he showed her the fragmentation grenade he held in his right hand. She glanced at the deeply checkered black metal orb. It looked like some evil, poisonous fruit, and she shuddered and averted her eyes.
It'll be as quick and more certain, he whispered reassuringly. And we go together at the very same moment.
He knew what he had to do. He would hold the grenade between them as they lay chest to chest. He looked up again at the approaching hind. It was very close. It was almost time. He would not warn her. He would simply kiss her one last time. And then...